Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, all those on Zoom. Hello. We're going to just have you here to listen in on the teachings. All over the world there. It's wonderful. And you'll participate by, I guess, just listening and watching. So, thank you. I was wondering, Marion, do you know how to, maybe Michael would like to, our master, chant master, can you put Michael on? Do you know how to do that? See if Michael would like to, because Michael won't be, he can hear us. Can hear
yes.
you.
Hello?
Barely.
Hello, do you hear me?
Yes.
Good.
Would you like to do the guest chanting for today?
Yes.
Well, that's nice. Then when you're not able to join us, then Shalane can become the chant master. How's that? Well, Michael, if you would lead us in the preliminary liberating instructions, that would be great. By the way, if I may just say for a second, for those that are new, these preliminary liberating instructions are the liberating instructions for Dzogchen. So we say these because they're of such profundity, but they're also the core contemplations and meditations for leading one into Dzogchen, but also they're of Dzogchen quality. So go ahead, please, Michael.
The four thoughts that turn the mind from samsara. Gopam drulte jamdhya nate ramjiriyam chinagki dradangwe namjinge parvidayi dakshan mita tridita parve nehi garje kyam tewe gokama chipe Sipe de la vita war, yangang de pe lam duto. De jor nudi lam del chir, lam om gusto mi gepam. Gewe de la bepakye, gosom dam si ko asom.
As his excellent body of mind reflection
and balance will be difficult to obtain and repeat in the future.
Right now I will accomplish the state of events and pass Samantabhadra to be even better than others.
Also
it is uncertain when the hateful enemy of this present precious body, the Maharaj's death, will arise. I mean, other beings are impermanent, to time of death being uncertain.
And since there
is no opportunity for happiness where everyone is born in samsara, and since a happy existence was never seen, I will enter the path of Nirvana. In order for his body, elation, and wealth to possess meaning, I will abandon the three non-virtuous poisonous afflictions, develop diligence in virtuous actions, and protect the vows and commitments of the three lords.
Going for refuge. Jinda Kunjung Lama Lakyachi Guru Sose Yidam Lakyachi Bhashya Kamse Kangro Lakyachi Kangi Sobo Sangye Lakyachi Shiva Chandra Damshu Lakyachi
Nakashi, Sokishin Jogen Nakashi, Trinle Yanda Chokyula Kaoyashi.
From now until the day of one's past awakening, I am all other sentient beings in equal space of refuge to the source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Inami Sober Supreme Citadel. We go for refuge to the Dakini Speller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the Supreme Field of Accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharma Pala, Sanatas, for activity. Namo, from now until the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all other sentient beings equal to space go for refuge to the Guru, source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Inami, restorer of Supreme City. We go for refuge to the Dakini, dispeller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the Supreme Field of Accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharma Palace, the Masses of Activities. Generating Bodhicitta.
Nyaya Korve Sanjen Dungan Dangarjin Deva Chova Kampare Laka Gunla Tanyo Nyampe Sanchodi Jangchu Nimpo Toshke Dagiki Dagi Rodru Sanjen Gendarji Sanjaki Gopang Sehir Tupajaya Deshiji Rasa Loje Nimpo Nam Lame Sehir Rabbe
All sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering, enjoy joyful and truly abiding in supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind impartial to us all in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching, the path of the luminously clear Vajra essence. May all sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abiding in supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind impartial to others all in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching, the path of the luminously clear Vajra essence. Hundred syllable Vajra Sattva Mantra.
Nilaya om bendrasatta sammaya manupalaya bendrasatta venopati shodrito me bhava sutokayo me bhava supokayo me bhava anurakto me bhava sarva siri me praya sarva karma sucham me chitam shriyam kuruhum ahahahum bhagavan sarva tata gata vendramane muncha vendri bhavan mahasammaya sato Om Bendra Satto Sammaya Manupalaya Bendra Satto Tvenopa Trishto Trino Mevava Soto Kayo Mevava Supo Kayo Mevava Anurakto Mevava Sarva Siddhi Mevraya Sarva karma sucham me chitam shriyam kuruvam Ahaho bhagavan sarva tata gata Vendrama me muncha vendri bhavam mahasamvaya sato Om Vendra Sattva Sammaya Manupalaya Vendra Sattva Tvenopa Trishodrino Mevava Sotokayam Sarva karma sukhame chitam shriyam guru aho bhagavan sarva tata gata indra mame mancha yantri bhavam mahasamaya sato
om vinsa sato om short mental to be sent to Maharaja, to reach the flowers and glories to the four continents and the sun. By offering the visualized Buddha field, may all migrating beings take birth in pure birth. Om Guru Deva Dakini Ratna Mangala Pratichas Swaha. Guru Yoga Accumulation Recitation. Bless us to accomplish the rainbow body.
Tajita shame shame vati shame tashram mangare mangare marati kurte keure tesoti olane vishunya namale mala panaye kakure kaka grase grasane umuke parumuke amuke shami tvarani sarva graha bandhanani grinnavata sarva para pavalina me mukta mara pasha svavita buddha mudra nutikata sarva mare pushta rita pari shuddhe bhigansatu sarva mara kammani. If anybody is ever wondering or gets lost in what Dzogchen is or isn't, or neither is nor isn't, and that's not just intellectual play, it isn't. It is, but isn't. If you look at the Guru Yoga accumulation recitation on page 7, the summary and meaning of Dzogchen is really there, the key experiences, the key realizations, that one's own, the Buddha field is one's own original pure awareness. It's a palace of unceasing inner radiance. Everything's there. It's all the Dzogchen key points are right there. It is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru. So guru is identical to one's Buddha nature and to one's primordial mind, to whom we supplicate with devoted mind, an absolutely lucidly confident mind, and may we be blessed to attain the rainbow body, which is the not just empty of form, but is both the intrinsic nature, undefinable, ungraspable by the mind, unspeakable, dharmakaya, and also inseparable with the form bodies of Buddhas, the sambhogakaya and nirmanakaya. So if you ever forget what is the meaning of Dzogchen, what are the key experiences of Dzogchen, right here, summarized. We ask for those blessings. So, wonderful. So this morning we begin a fairly detailed commentary of Nāragarjuna's commentary on bodhicitta, called the Bodhicitta Vivarana. And we're going to go through it bit by bit because it explains all of Dharma, but it also, stage by stage, moves us towards key points and key meditations of generation stage and completion stage, especially completion stage, mostly completion stage, but also generation stage, and towards Mahamudra Dzogchen realizations. So contains some of the key points of everything we're probably ever going to do in Dharma. I've been very fortunate to receive a number of translations, so I'll rely on different translations as well as my own exposition of meaning. This text is extremely difficult to translate. But many have taken a good shot at it, many experts, and it's great that we have these different translations. So to open the Dzogchen retreat with the theme of with the importance of bodhicitta, I've decided on this text because some people both here in the room and also who are participating on Zoom have never received the reading transmission for this, and this is one of the core texts, key texts, of all Tibetan curriculum that one would undertake. So if you're a monastic in any single school, you would study this in great depth, and you'd debate it, study it, and contemplate. So the text begins, the one that you have, which is an excellent translation overall, yet I'll put in all kinds of other words to clarify and give different commentaries on it. It says, homage to glorious Vajrasattva. And Vajrasattva here, there is a connection with Nāragarjuna. Nāragarjuna was a great yogi as well as an amazing scholar, reputed to be from South India, and a highly attained being. He wrote some of the most important texts on the middle way teaching called Madhyamaka teaching, of which I was very fortunate to study one in university, kind of the core text. With Dr. Werder, that was a major part of a whole course. It was great. He has a deep connection to Vajrasattva. Now, for those that don't know, or for those that do, Vajrasattva is the Sambhogakaya emanation, Sambhogakaya form body, if you wish, of the ultimate Buddha nature. So we practice Vajrasattva for great purification, but Vajrasattva here represents the form bodies, the manifest communication, bliss form bodies of primordial wisdom, primordial Buddha nature. And this is really something, because Vajrasattva, you'll see in Dzogchen, especially in Dzogchen teachings, and also new school teachings as well, Vajrasattva plays a key component as being the center of, often the center of the mandala, but also the being that received, like he's not really a being, but a beingness that received the full transmission of Dharmakaya, the suchness and totality that's not even speakable. It's beyond words. And Vajrasattva here gives clear teaching through Nargarjuna, gives clear teaching on the nature of the awakening mind, bodhicitta. So we practice Vajrasattva a lot because Vajrasattva is considered to be one of the great purification meditations. But if you really want to know about Vajrasattva and the scope of Vajrasattva, if you ever wonder, what am I really practicing with Vajrasattva? This is it. This is like Vajrasattva's mind. The ability to expound, the ability to engulf all beings in the radiance of Dharma is extraordinary. So more on that later. So it's a homage to glorious Vajrasattva. He considers, of course, Vajrasattva his guru. And Vajrasattva is the radiance. When you see here on this page 7 on the Guru Yoga accumulation, it says, in the palace of unceasing inner radiance. This is Sambhogakaya. The radiance never ceases. Whether you try to stop it or not, the radiance of enlightened activity, unimpeded, effortless, communicative, enlightened activity is unstoppable. It never stops. It never dries up. It never goes away. It doesn't matter what we're doing. It's there. Vajrasattva is always there. Vajrasattva is the radiance of one's mind in its pristine form, with no cloudiness or no obscurations. Now, his prologue, which isn't in the text, doesn't say prologue, but the introduction, like many great, this is not a Tibetan text, it's an Indian text, but like many great Indian and Tibetan texts, everything is actually in the prologue, everything you'd ever need. Everything's given in the prologue. So let's enter into it. It has been stated. Devoid of all entities. Utterly discarding all objects and subjects, such as aggregates, elements, and sense fields. Due to sameness of selflessness and of all phenomena, one's mind is primordially unborn. It is in the nature of emptiness. So this is how it starts at a very high level. It tells you what really is the key point of the text, is the emptiness of all phenomena. So in the first turning of the Buddha's teaching, which is called Hinayana by the Mahayanas, the others don't call it that, but the first turning of the wheel is primarily concerned to lead you to discover the emptiness of self, the non-solidity of self, which is where the suffering is. So whenever one self-references, whenever one considers subject and object, whenever one has dualistic thinking, whenever one has greed, hatred, delusion, then we have solidity. We create a solidity in consciousness. And when we create a solidity in consciousness, it has an emotional solidity, it has a claustrophobic feeling, it has a tight feeling of restriction of me and you and them and they and space and non-space, light and darkness, all these kinds of things, which don't actually exist. But they exist in the conceptual mind. So this first point, this prologue, which we haven't finished the prologue, but he's going to explain this point here about the empty nature of all phenomena, not just self-phenomena, all phenomena, in 112 verses. This is extraordinary to do this. I'm going to read a little further and come back to that because I need to explain aggregates, elements, and sense fields. But I will say this. The key point for right now, and I think for many, many years to come, for all of us, is to really refine our understanding of what Dharma, the word Dharma, means. Now, you can say, well, that's great. I can look it up and I can see Dharma means this. But actually, the word Dharma and the teaching of Dharma, very much from the Abhidhamma point of view, and this the point of view of Nargarjuna's text, is to understand that which is a concept and that which is beyond concepts. It's not to get rid of concepts, but if you really, with wisdom and heart, understand and mind, understand concepts, you see really the suffering of beings, the dukkha, the stress, the confusion, the harm, the friction, the illness, the dis-ease of beings is caused, yes, by self, by self-referencing, but it's not really the problem from the Mahayana and the Vajrayana point of view. Really what is the difficulty is the belief in concepts as being real. This is a key point. And we are concepts. We may not feel like concepts for a while, but we are concepts. Everything about us is a concept. So the Buddha tried through his 40 years of over 40 years of teaching, in the first turning of the wheel, to demolish and help beings really realize that the solidity of self is an illusion. But he didn't really go into a great exposition on the empty nature of all phenomena. Okay? And so we'll come back to that. And next, just as the blessed Buddhas and the great Bodhisattvas have generated the mind of great awakening, I too shall, from now until I arrive at the heart of awakening. Heart means essence of awakening. Heart, essence, core, kernel. Ningpo, it's all through this text. Ningpo, the Ningpo of awakening, Ningpo of Bodhi. Generate the awakening mind in order that I may save those who are not saved, save from dukkha, save from bewilderment, free those who are not free, relieve those who are not relieved, and help thoroughly transcend sorrow, those who have not thoroughly transcended sorrow. Those bodhisattvas who practice by means of the secret mantrayana, that is Vajrayana, or Tantrayana. After having generated awakening mind in terms of its conventional aspect, in the form of aspiration, must then produce the ultimate awakening mind through the force of meditative practice. I shall therefore explain its nature. A beautiful prologue. So here he's going to explain verse by verse by verse the understanding of a great bodhisattva or a Buddha. That's a wonderful gift. So like a sadhana, like a meditative practice like Vajrasattva, Chenrezig, Dorje Drolo, Guru Rinpoche, White Tara, Green Tara, all these practices are practices by which we would place our mind, our body, and our speech in the placement of a Mahabodhisattva, a great Bodhisattva, or a Buddha, in the same way he's going to go through the realization of a great Bodhisattva, greatly attained being. And I think this text is extraordinarily important for all those who study and practice Vajrayana teachings, whether a supported Mahamudra, or unsupported Mahamudra Dzogchen. So there's so much in this, and it's worth spending a bit of time on. When we say devoid of all real entities, this is the point. Entityness means that experience sees and hears and feels experience as a solid thing. This is the key point. There's many key points, but this is central. We are trained, not diabolically, not because it's a conspiracy, but we're trained to, we grow up with words and concepts. We have to do this to socialize and communicate and to manipulate. If we want to manipulate, we want to do things in the world, if we want to talk, if we want to do all the kinds of things that we do as social beings, we have to actually have concepts. The problem is that we don't remember that they were concepts. We forget very quickly as adults and even teenagers that there was a time when we didn't know what a flower was, we just saw a flower. We had no idea. And then we were told it's a flower, it's not mummy. That's flower. And you say, mama. No, 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 no. Flower. So by doing that, and it's not wrong, but it's not right, we concretize the world into the concept as being the concept and the name and the thought about it as a real existent entity, when in fact it's a thought, an idea that actually has no innate structure. It has, you'll find nothing in there. So if you fly into a cloud with an airplane, from the outside, the cloud looks like a solid cloud. As soon as you enter the cloud as an airplane, in an airplane, or if some of you can fly, maybe some of you here are at the level of attainment and yoginis, that you commonly fly through clouds, well, that's great. Then you will know that the cloud has no solid nature. You can pass right through it, just like a rainbow. But then you'll say, yeah, but how about houses and walls? People have been known to do that. Sometimes they crash through the wall and make a mess with gyprock flying everywhere and 2x4s going everywhere. And sometimes there's reports of great practitioners who actually pass through walls. And sometimes our intelligence and concepts hire a backhoe or a front end loader and we quickly pass through walls. Are you getting an idea? Dynamite really does a very quick job, is it? So, but the actual backhoe or caterpillar tractor, whatever it is, front end loader, is our conceptual mind. We built those things for a job, which is to remove material, which for that concept called a backhoe, the house is a very flimsy piece. If you've ever taken down a house, I've watched one of my houses go. It took 20 minutes to take down an entire house with a backhoe. 20 minutes, I watched it. To rubble, complete rubble. It was nothing for the backhoe. The backhoe is a concept driven, run by a conceptual mind. We only have a concept that the house is solid. It's in no way solid. But here's the real suffering. It's not about houses so much. It can be. Some people, terrible. But when it comes to us, which is what the teaching is about, it's about us suffering. It's because the ideas about us and others and other entities are solid, real things. And we don't understand that they're not. So, therefore, in the first cycle of teaching of the Buddha, which you can see summarized in the Theravada and Abhidhamma, there are entities that are considered to be real and entities that are considered to be unreal concepts. Those are enumerated. There's a list. 202 names of things are real. All the rest of everything else is not. Consciousness is real. States of mind are real. Earth, water, fire, air is real. And all the subcategories that come out of that, 28 form. And we have Nibbana. All that makes up 20, makes up 202 entities that are indivisible. You can't go any further. Only those are real things. All the rest, including human beings, Laurel, Mark, Jeff, tea, coffee, walls, chairs, tonkas, skull cups, mandala offering kits, rocks, all those are actually concepts, conceptual fabrications. When it comes to Mahayana and Vajrayana teaching, all those 200 classifications, which are considered real in the first cycle of teaching the Dharma, are considered unreal. Even those are unreal. So he says, devoid of all real entities, utterly free, all objects and subjects, that is, all experience to us and us, both the experience and the experiencer. Then he says, then he goes into the Abhidhamma classification, the teachings of the Buddha, all the aggregates, that is, form, that is, our body, our form, our experience of forms, earth, water, fire, and air, our feelings, our mental feelings of pleasurable, unpleasurable, neutral, our perception, our volitional states, our 50 or 52 volitional states, and all of our subject-object consciousness, which the Buddha considered in the first teaching of the Wheel of Dharma, is considered to be real, true entities. But here, these aggregates, elements, and sense fields, elements being earth, water, fire, and air, and sense fields being the seeing, hearing, and so on, including cognition. These sense fields are all devoid of a true endpoint of entity. Due to sameness of selflessness of all phenomena, that is, all phenomena are not solid. They are empty of an endpoint of solidity. One's mind is primordially unborn. So if you trace this all back, and you practice these meditations which are given, these are the key meditations. You trace this back. Not only do you find, this is the key point, not only do you find that your self-experience is devoid of a solidity, but then you see that all experience to your mind is utterly devoid of an entity. Now you may say, well, that's just terrible. We're now left with nothing. Not at all. If you do this correctly, if you do it incorrectly, and you misunderstand, and it's actually not real experience, and it's emotional experience of depression or most emotional experience of nihilism, you will come out with a nihilistic attitude. But if you actually do the practices and you actually do the steps correctly, you will come to the experience that all bodhisattvas and mahabodhisattvas and Buddhas come to, which is luminous, great love emptiness. This is Dzogchen and Mahamudra. That this emptiness, in fact, is radiant compassion that liberates freely and effortlessly. Just like the sun warming everywhere. Eventually the sun pokes through. So one's mind is primordially unborn was taught in the first, not primordially, that's the key word. Mind being as unborn is actually contained in the first teachings of the Buddha. Unborn. Primordially unborn, from the very no beginning. The mind does not die, it does not arise, it's not created. And it's ultimately free. This is very much Mahayana and Vajrayana teaching. So these are not theories. These are born of genuine meditative experience. This is the heart of meditative experience. And so for an intelligent practitioner of Dharma, you now know where you're going. And you should take this attitude. I'm going to find the unborn. That's what I'm doing. Whether you're practicing Chenrezig, or you're practicing Guru Rinpoche, or you're practicing the Guru Yoga of Nyingma Dorje, whether you're practicing Vajragini or Tara, you're going to find, you want to discover and find the unborn nature of all phenomena, just not just yourself. This is what it is. It's right there. That's it. And this unborn, of course, is the nature of emptiness. Not a nihilistic emptiness, as he says later on, he counters that, nihilistic emptiness, a full emptiness, a rich emptiness. And this also means the three Buddha bodies. We use the term generating the mind of great awakening, generating the mind of Maha Bodhicitta. And the word generation is important because from the point of view of what he said above, unborn and empty, you really can't create bodhicitta. You have to find bodhicitta. You have to find the unity of emptiness and compassion and discover it as inherent nature. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're fabricating and creating compassion as a concept and emptiness as a concept. So the teachings of Vajrayana are not to create, they're to find. It sometimes feels like you're building and you're creating this complex edifice. But actually, that complex edifice, as natural luminosity, is already there. Hard to believe for many people, but already there. You have to encounter it. So we are going to generate the mind of bodhicitta. We're going to generate it because we're bringing it forth, but we're trying to get away from conventionally creating it. So that's why we rely on prayers and contemplations that are really high, because we're kind of trying to suck it out of the ether, if you wish, or the field of awake mind, and not just create it with our conceptual mind. We're letting non-conceptual wisdom mind speak to non-conceptual wisdom mind, which eventually comes through to our conceptual mind. Then we say, I too, we make a vow, we make a commitment, I too, from now until we arrive at the heart of awakening, the very kernel, Ningpo, generate the awakening mind in order that we may save those who are not saved. Saved from what? Has anybody noticed before or now the state of beings? Let's just talk about human beings. Human beings are amazing creatures, but they really go through it. And they go through it because concepts, the belief in concepts. And they go through it because they want to be happy. But have you noticed that many things that we think make us happy don't make us happy? Found that? That's good. So you, as fairly enlightened beings, so we'll do this and we'll say, even the ones on Zoom there, you all as quite enlightened beings may not see it that way, because we also live in a godlike realm. We live in an extraordinary time, even with COVID. And anybody in the room who complains about kind of what they're going through, it may be good to teleport to India or teleport to places where it's just abject suffering. Well, it actually has been for a long time. So saving beings from the conceptual contrivances that embroil them in suffering is what saving means. Helping a person wake up from the conceptual conflict when there doesn't need to be any. From the point of view of an awakened being, there simply doesn't need to be any. Isn't that amazing? If you go to a doctor and you ask the doctor for help, and they give you a diagnosis that's clear and precise, and they say, take this, or we'll do this, or change your lifestyle. Let's say, an example, maybe something like, in some cases, type 2 diabetes. And if you go in with early type 2 diabetes, many studies have shown, if you go in early and you change your diet and change your lifestyle, lo and behold, the type 2 diabetes disappears. Also, if you change your gut microbes because of your diet, it has a lot to do with it. But if you say, no, I'm not going to. I want to eat the same foods I've been eating all my life. I want to continue to lead the lifestyle I want to lead, and so on. What do you think the doctor's thinking? Won't change. In other words, it won't change the concept, and you'll get sicker and sicker and sicker and eventually have these symptoms and so on. So in the same way, the doctor of Dharma, the Buddha, the doctor of Dharma, is saying if you actually hold and cling to concepts as real, self, others as real, and so on, and not see its nature, not really grasp its nature from the inside, the Ningpo, from the heart, then you're going to really suffer. Not only will you suffer physically, but you'll suffer mentally. Make sense? So if you don't, you have to take the medicine. What's the medicine? Medicine is teaching of emptiness and compassion. So this is, if anybody says this is all about emptiness, yes, but it's also incredibly great love. Yeah. Why? To save those who are not yet saved. Free those who are not free. Relieve from suffering, relieve from confusion, those who are not relieved, and help thoroughly transcend sorrow. What was sorrow? Dukkha. Dukkha is not understanding the nature of the conceptual experience. Those who have not thoroughly transcended sorrow, not thoroughly, completely. So here you see an attitude of the Dharma Center, not just the Dharma Center of Canada, but of Dharma, is not just to be free a little bit, but to aim to be free completely. I think some of you have heard me say this maybe too many times, like a broken record, but I firmly believe that if you only aim a little bit, you get half a little bit. I'm a real firm believer from the evidence I've seen in my own life and teaching that if you aim people high, and even if they don't believe they can get high attainment, at least if they don't get full liberation, they'll get some pretty darn good liberation. But if you don't aim for pretty high liberation, you may only get a fraction. And that fraction is maybe insufficient, not really liberation. So I think it's very good for intelligent beings like yourselves to teach at the highest level. You all can do it if you want to. If you go really for full liberation, even if you were to attain, could you imagine, even if you attain only the first bodhisattva level, what an amazing gift that would be. Instead of not. So now some people don't want to. You may say, some of you out there may say, but I don't want to. I don't want to attain anything. I just want to be a little happier. But that little bit of happier may be okay for a couple years. But our experience, I think most of you know this, our experience is that little happiness, or happier readjustment of life will fade under the circumstances of life's changes, vicissitudes. You may have it all together and then COVID comes along. You may discover you don't know where your finances are. You may discover you have no business. You may discover you have no means of income. You may discover that what you thought was normal and real and you could do things isn't there anymore. And where's your happiness? So when happiness is tied to conceptual form, when happiness is tied to conceptual constructs, it's going to evaporate under the change of concepts in a life. Loss of a loved one, loss of our pets, loss of our homes, loss of our income, loss of our comforts, loss of ideas. Even ideas, the loss of ideas, can throw us completely for a loop. Who we are, where we're going, who we should be, why we're here, why we shouldn't be here. All these things, these concepts, right, can just demolish our happiness. I hope this is pretty clear. I don't know. Let me know if it isn't. So it's really good to want to thoroughly, even if you don't want to right now, if you study with me, I'll badger you. I guarantee I will badger you, repetitively badger you towards full awakening as the only thing I can do. I will badger you over and over again by prayers, quack, 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 texts, prayers of the mind and body, speech, and mind of full liberation, because I think it's the most compassionate. But that doesn't mean that everybody wants to, and it also doesn't mean that everybody's going to come for teachings. There's lots that won't. But if you have the strength and you have the gumption, I like that word, gumption, if you've got the guts, the strength, it's good to go for full, complete liberation. So what is in the way? Saved from what? Awija. Saved from delusion, saved from thinking that you can hang on to concepts when in fact you can't. But on the other side, the entire teaching of Dharma is high-level concept. So you work with high-level, because someone's going to say in the room there, some intelligent being in the room there, is going to go, yeah, but Lama, the whole Dharma, it's all concepts, right? It's like smoke and mirrors. Yes, it is. It just happens to be concept that's very close to ultimate nature, as opposed to very far away from ultimate nature. So this is the only difference, is that whatever words we use, whatever texts we use, is pointing to something that's utterly free. That's all. But it's much closer to pointing than concepts that are much further away. Because as he says here, we arrive at the heart of awakening, at the core, the kernel, and that's what we're going for. So imagine someone like yourselves saying, I would like to practice archery. Has anybody ever practiced archery here? It's not a trick question. Okay. But imagine you step up to shoot an arrow at the target and say, but I don't want to hit the bullseye. I just want to shoot arrows. That's kind of nice, isn't it, shooting arrows? But eventually, you decide, what would it be like to be able to hit the bullseye once in 15 arrows? And once that happens, you may go, could I do 2 arrows into the bullseye in 15 arrows? Did you get the feeling? So for someone to practice archery and just shoot arrows randomly like this, there's kind of a joy in that, isn't it? But to be able to hit the bullseye consistently and know how that's done, not just once, wow, I had an experience, not just once, but be able to consistently find the way to bring the arrow into the bullseye. That's what we're talking about here. Those bodhisattvas who practice by skill and means, concepts, high-level concepts, high-level practices of the secret mantra, the secret vajrayana, the skill and means, the methods of Vajrayana, after having generated awakening mind in terms of its conventional aspect. So when we practice the bodhicitta prayer here, and most of our practices, we are practicing bodhicitta awakening. We're trying to stir up bodhicitta that's there. Do you get the idea? You're trying to stir up bodhicitta that's already there by doing these practices. I don't know how to say this, but you're churning milk. You're taking butter and you're churning the butter until the milk comes out. You're squeezing the olives until the pure olive oil comes out. You're churning. So all these practices are churning. You're refining the gold out of the ore, crushing the ore. Yeah? And that's all we're doing. And that's why it feels hard to do. That's why some of you say, God, this is hard. Sometimes. Sometimes you say it's glorious. Sometimes you say it's very hard. Why? Because we're actually breaking up stuckness and concepts. Like solid, apparently solid olives in an olive press. And you're squeezing really hard to get the juice out. The juice is Ningpo, is the heart of awakening. And that's what we're looking for. So all this, if you understand what we're doing, every transmission, every teaching, the refuge tree, all these practices is really just squeezing out the oil of bodhicitta, emptiness, compassion, until it's so apparent that that's the way our being naturally resides and naturally communicates and naturally wishes for beings because it was already there. That's the great discovery. So we deal with conventional aspects in the form of aspiration and then must produce the ultimate awakening mind through the force of meditative experience. We have to meditate. We have to meditate. But if we don't have the force of bodhicitta, we end up meditating on tranquility. But if we put the force of bodhicitta and the force of understanding in with our meditation, it's awesome. That's what this is about. I shall therefore explain its nature. I'm going to pause there. And I like that first part, that prologue. Any questions?
Mm-hmm. Do you like the idea of using the word cultivate instead of generate?
I like both. But I kind of like generate. And that may be just a personal feeling at the moment, and maybe next year it's going to be cultivate. I like the idea of cultivating fields, idea of cultivating your garden, cultivating beings, awakening mind. I like cultivation. And generation I like too, because generation to me, is like turning on a generator that's already there. So I think for right now I like generate, but I think cultivate's good too. Cultivation has some qualities too, like generation, that the seeds are already there. These are really agrarian models, agrarian metaphors, is the seeds are already, they're in the soil, and you have to cultivate the soil. You have to cultivate the plant. So, from the point of view of the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, from the view of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, the seed form of awakening is already present, always present in all beings' minds. So yes, you either have to cultivate or generate. And both words work very well. I don't really have a like or you. I've used cultivate a lot too. I think right now I'm into generation. So, but no negativity towards cultivate. I do a lot of cultivation in my life. I think lots of us should cultivate. That's actually all we're doing all the time anyways. We're just cultivating. I mean, if you look at everybody's life, we're cultivating. Is there anything else we do but cultivate? We also destroy. But that can be an act of cultivation too. Cultivate, you also have to take all the plants in your garden or your field and either dig them up or bury them back in again. So that's also cultivation. Generation. But the point I've always had about these texts is be very careful that you're not creating something new. You're generating something that's from the point of view of a Vajrayana practitioner. You have to be careful that you keep having the view that you're finding what's already there, not creating something that you want. Because as soon as you want it to be a certain way, you've lost bodhicitta. You want to find natural bodhicitta that's just utterly effortless. You'll see later on in the teachings, compassion that's effortless, compassion that has no conceptual contrivance, but is very intelligent. Yeah.
But also the effort is involved in fostering the conditions.
That's right. That's right. So you have to use conceptual contrivance to create the right conditions, the right auspicious conditions for the plants and the flowers and the fruit trees to emerge. So that's what we're doing here at the Dharma Center of Canada. The Dharma Center of Canada having a teacher, the Dharma Center of Canada having you come together, the room and everything else are the auspicious conditions like water, fertilizer, soil, good seeds and so on to come for a natural fruition of what's already there. That's what we're doing. It's very hard to get olives, to get the oil out of olives without an olive press. You can stomp on them, but it makes a mess. You can try to squeeze them in your hands, but if you don't have the right auspicious conditions, you don't get a lot of olive oil. Make sense? Just, it won't work. Yes. I believe that's a mask, Nick, back there.
It is.
Okay.
Very good. The idea or the view of unborn, empty mind seems so utterly divorced from our conditioned experience. It seems to me that faith comes into play in understanding that the system works to a certain extent.
Very good.
Is that the right view?
Yes. And so this comes to a question of devotion and faith and confidence. And as I've said many times, it is none of your faults of having doubts. It's simply to do with being in a culture. It's a very different culture. If you get born into the East, awakening beings and awake beings, and this view is utterly normal. But to be born into our recent culture, it isn't at all. So. Even if you're a Buddhist, a Western Buddhist, there's many kinds of things that you're not going to feel comfortable with because you've never grown up in that culture. And number two, there's many things in Western society that are very recent, by the way, in Western society. It feels very old, but it's not. Very recent, that are contrary to that view. But remembering that this is not incredibly ancient, it's extremely well practiced, way longer than our modern scientific tradition. As a practicing scientist, I actually have in some ways more confidence in this than any of the scientific work we do. Not to say it's wrong, but people think science is fact. All science is provisional. It's based on stats, on probability. This is looking for freedom that doesn't come or go. And I would say that quite a few, it's mainstream in science now, completely mainstream in science regarding interconnectivity, interdependence. That's now mainstream. I was just showing Laurel another article I just pulled off. It just got published yesterday in a very prestigious magazine. It's all about interdependence, interplay, interdependence. But and emptiness is quite the illusory nature of emptiness is mainstream in neurocognitive sciences. And emptiness as devoid of entityness, not compassion, but devoid of entityness, is mainstream physics. But to bring compassion and emptiness together from this view, we're far away in science. Science does an amazingly good job at what it does. It's fantastic, actually. I mean, to have a vaccine in less than a year, you know that someone made a vaccine in 3 hours after the publication of the genetic code of COVID? I don't know if you know that. 3 hours the team produced the first vaccine. untested in 3 hours just by getting the code off the computer published by the Chinese. And that's in California. That took 21 years to do that. 3 hours. Science does a really good job of what it does, but it's still provisional. No vaccine is 100%. No antibiotic is 100%. No surgery is 100%. No physics is 100%. But it can work very well. So, is this 100%? What's 100% is the unborn nature of the mind. It's been declared by thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of great masters, the freedom. What it's going to be like for all of us, who knows? Doesn't matter. So it is far out for most Westerners. You have to be in a certain place to be able to actually hear this and have some inkling of confidence where you go, this sounds really right. Does it make sense? And that's the beginning of the confidence. Depending on how much, if you want, from a Buddhist standpoint, and from my standpoint, how much work has been done in past lives, not your past lives, they're connected to you. It can come quickly, it can become indisputable, or it can come very, very slowly. Therefore, we have teachings like this that are incredibly logical, totally logical. These have been debated in monasteries with incredible logic and are debated today. They can't break this. You can't break the logic of this. And Nagarjuna was one of the, and is considered by Western philosophers now as one of the greatest geniuses of logic and epistemology. So we use these texts to come to an intellectual, heartfelt conviction which really supports our meditation. If we don't, the greatest monster of all meditation retreats and all meditators and all Buddhist practitioners is doubt. That kills everybody. It's what nails everybody. It's doubt. These texts are here to remove the last little bits of doubt. And one might have to hear it 30 times. One might have to read it 30 times. Does that make sense? So it's doubt. And we're in a culture of doubt. So if you have a hard time with this, sometimes, and Buddhism and Dharma, it's because we live in that kind of culture that allows us to hear Dharma and actually get our head around Dharma, but actually have a profound disbelief in Buddha nature and profound disbelief in liberation because it's completely foreign to our culture. But it wasn't 200 years ago. And it wasn't 300 years ago. It was mainstream. Only the last couple hundred years with the advent of modern enlightenment period and scientific reasoning have we lost sight of the absolute logic of liberation, of enlightenment, whether it's a Christian mystical enlightenment, Sufi enlightenment, Native American enlightenment. We've lost sight of, a lot of us have lost sight of that. This is extremely precise enlightenment with high precision. Any others? Any other questions? These are good. Yeah, let's go on a little bit further. Let me explain for many in the room. Has everybody in the room practiced? Is there anybody who has not practiced meditation? Is anybody new to Dharma in the room? Oh, good. One of the differences when it says meditative practice, through the force of meditative practice, is in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha taught the way of understanding emptiness through anicca, dukkha, anatta, through transitoriness, through dukkha, through dis-ease or friction or uncomfortableness and suffering, and through anatta, through the non-entity-ness of self. But those three contemplations of insight in the, let's say, in the Theravada, which really was pretty mainstream in 18 different schools, not just the Theravada schools. When it says meditative practice, it changes over from a relatively high insight of anicca dukkha anatta to the unborn luminous nature of experience. That's really what you have. So when he says meditative experience, it doesn't mean anicca dukkha anatta. He actually means the luminous special insight, the penetrative insight of luminous free mind, which means Buddha nature. Bowing to the glorious Vajra holder. Actually, there's some other translations here. I'm going to go back a bit. Other translations which are quite revealing here. It says, if we go back a little bit, this is a lovely translation. I don't think it's so literal, but it's fine. It is by reflecting thus that bodhisattvas who engage in the practice of secret mantrayana, or mantra, must first cultivate relative bodhicitta, which has the character of an intention. I like that. That's great. I just spoke about that, but I think that's really well put. Is the translation there is really speaking to it, is where do you start? You have to have a strong intention of bodhicitta to generate the seeds, to uncover the seeds of full liberation. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're cultivating a field of your liberation, but not the liberation of the emptiness of all phenomena, which is how a Buddha or a great bodhisattva experiences. That's very good. Here's another translation. Very similar, but a little bit different. When a bodhisattva, having practiced a course by way of mantras, a way of protection, mantras are protection, but they're also awareness, seeds of awareness, has thus produced the bodhicitta that in its relative aspect has the nature of aspiration. He or she must, by means of meditational development, produce the absolute bodhicitta. Therefore, I will reveal its nature. Beautifully put, too. These are great. So, when it says force of meditative practice, it's also saying here, the force of intent is absolutely essential. Without that, you really don't go very far. You can abide in a tranquil mind, which for some is very good, by the way. We all need a tranquil mind, and it feels great. And it gives us confidence we're on the right track. So we need to develop tranquility, no question about it. But tranquility may not contain the force of intention for awakening. We need that. One, bowing to the glorious Vajra holder, Vajradhara, Vajrasattva. Now, here when we say Vajra holder, we also mean the guru, the Yadam, and the Dakini. So literally, Vajra holder is Vajradhara. So some texts just say the glorious one. Others say Vajra holder. Some say Vajrasattva. So it depends on how you want to translate it. Who embodies the awakening mind. So when we look to Vajrasattva for becoming Vajrasattva or experiencing Vajrasattva or trying to be Vajrasattva, it is the encapsulation, the full, if you want, the full meal, deal of Bodhicitta, Maha Bodhicitta. I shall explain here the meditative practice of awakening mind that destroys cyclic existence, destroys blindly subject to becoming. I would prefer instead of destroy is okay. You know, there's a time in our lives where destroy is okay, But if you look up, which I did at some point, the Sanskrit or the Tibetan, it really means to abolish, to rid, not so much to destroy, to. Sometimes we need to destroy things, and sometimes we need to abolish. They have a subtle meaning. Let me also explain here about Vajrayana, how we practice in Vajrayana. If we're really practicing Vajrayana, we're going directly, everything we do in Vajrayana practice is about being a Mahabodhisattva or a Buddha from that viewpoint. It's going right to the heart of what pure experience is all about. When we practice in a Hinayana form, we're going to go after the non-entityness of our self-experience, whereas in Vajrayana, we're going after the non-entityness of all experience, no matter what it is. Okay? And that brings about great compassion. So how we interpret all experience is to do the degree of moving through cyclic existence, through moving through clinging. And this word cyclic existence refers to where all beings confine themselves is in three spheres. They're called the three spheres. The sphere of sensing, that includes hell beings, animals, pretas, is sensing. The beings who reside in a form absorption, meditative form absorption, mostly bliss, and beautiful states of clarity and non-thought, all the way through to beings who reside in a formless absorption, a godlike realm of formlessness, where there's no form to be seen, just infinite space, infinite light, not even a perception. So there's different degrees of this. So you can take all sentient beings, no matter what they are, and classify them by these three wanderings, these three places beings find themselves in, and that's what cyclic existence is here, the three avachana, to wander about, or samsara. So when you hear this text, as I said last night, don't feel you're not meditating. He's actually giving the great meditations. All the great meditations in the Theravadin, which is the main school that kind of won out, if you wish, out of 18 schools in early Buddhism. It's got differences with some others. Mahayana, Vajrayana. These are the core great meditations that you'll receive from Buddhist teachers all through these different cycles of teaching. So when he says he's going to explain the meditation, he's going to explain the very essence of these meditations and why we do these meditations. And then he's going to systematically demolish them. It's beautiful. He's going to run us through from beginning to end, and every time, you know, the straw man, every time he sets up a great meditation, go, okay, this is it. He's going to show why it has, I wouldn't say faults, why it is provisional. It doesn't take you to the highest level. And then again and again and again. So we have 112 verses like that. So I think that's good. We got to number one today, and as an introduction. Number one, and if you have any questions, great. I think that's a good place to pause. Also, if I'm going to teach for 2 hours, which I sometimes do, as you've noticed, then maybe you may ask for a pause. Let me know if you want a pause and a stretch. Because this is quite, for some of you, this is going to be quite dense material. deep material. Others, not so much. Do you want to go on any longer? Is that enough for this morning? Is that plenty?
There's a question.
Yes, please.
So what you just said about sort of encapsulating the narrative of this text suggests what you said yesterday, that the first thing you said was that you walk around building stories and what we have to do is cut them.
We normally can't cut them.
And this text seems to be suggesting that principle.
Let's talk about a kitchen. There's cutting and there's slow cutting. Most of us can't handle or contain, either can't emotionally handle, conceptually handle, one big cut. But most of us can handle very slow cutting, piece by piece by piece. This text is 112 piece by piece by piece. So out of compassion, most Dharma is taught piece by piece by piece by piece. It's just too much. I've seen people sick who've heard teachings of Dzogchen and Mahamudra, literally sick, who've been good practitioners for many years in other traditions and literally told me, they look like they're sick. They're holding their head. I'm concerned they're going to have a heart attack, literally like it says in the Heart Sutra, and they're having a very hard time hearing that there's not even any mind. It's like, or there's no anicca, there's not even any dukkha. It's like, they're literally sick.
Right.
So concepts presented at times when you can't handle them can make you sick, which may be compassionate, but may mean you can't hear it at all and you can't actually handle it. So that's where merit comes in. So Dzogchen, introduction of Dzogchen, traditionally, there's a long practice period before it where pure Dzogchen, hearing the ultimate view, which is the meditation, is introduced. But you've done all this work beforehand to hear it. Most of us have never had that. Therefore, we need to hear it, we need to be introduced to it, and some of us actually grasp it. But then we lose it. Therefore, most of Dharma teaching is little cuts into the conceptual base until one day it falls. It either falls because we're meditating so-called by ourselves or we're sitting in class listening to a teacher and we go, oh my goodness. Why? All that work before. So that's why we do retreats. That's why we study, we listen, we practice. Because one day it falls. Either we think we're by ourselves or we think we're by ourselves. It's not true. We are in a class, we're listening to it, we're reading a book of Dharma, and we go, oh my God, of course. Well, yeah, and it's right there. So it's by little cuts mostly. There are a few beings who, on hearing Dharma for the first time, it's done. But then they actually have to practice to unfold that. One, they won't be able to teach it. Number two, it often slips because the force of conditioning, even for great tulkus, tulkus can really, the force of human conditioning is so huge that it can get buried. So little cuts, little chops at conceptual solidity is really how most of the Dharma is taught, until it all collapses, into freedom. And if you don't do that, you probably also can't teach because you don't know how you got there. So this is the nature. Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was wondering if we're going to introduce like a beginner practice, because right now I've just been doing slowing down and being mindful, just generally trying to be aware. And I was just wondering if, because I'm hearing all this stuff and it sounds great and I'm excited to get like a practice. practice so that
tonight,
I can start
tonight.
Seeing it?
Tonight.
Tonight. Okay.
Yeah, this is a practice, but you have to know how to practice it. We've already given out really core practices, but now we have to back up and go step by step. And tonight I'll be introducing hollow body practice and loving kindness practice for everybody. And it's the core of Vajrayana practices. So, yep, starting tonight, we're going to introduce that. And also I'm going to give lots of teaching on mindfulness, the heart of mindfulness, more awareness and recollectedness and how that works and how to practice that. All right. So this is something that you integrate into your meditative practice. This is something you can meditate. And what I'd like you to do is do something that we were taught is lovely by, especially by Namjoon Rinpoche, which is just a lovely way to do it, is take this text and walk with it. Don't do any more than read the prologue today and verse 1. And just walk with it for 10, 15 minutes. Read it slowly and let it sink in. And don't worry, oh, I didn't get it. Oh, I don't understand it. Or I get it. Even if you get it, don't think you even got it. You know, I got it. What did you get? So contemplate it. So in the Dharma, there is, these are the steps. Listening to Dharma. So hear Dharma. Study Dharma. Reflect on Dharma. Contemplate on Dharma. And meditate on Dharma. And do the whole cycle again. So if you want to know what to do today, walk slowly, sit slowly, read this over and over again as you've never read it before. Look at your notes, relax, maybe even like this sometimes, not necessarily always like this, but like this, and go, what does that mean? By asking the question, it will come to you. And relax your mind, and read, and reflect, and pause. The other thing I'd like you to do as a meditative practice all day long is I really want all of you to learn to stop what you're doing. Just stop. And when you stop, stop again. Learn to completely stop. Stop standing, stand. And then stop standing, standing. When you sit, sit. Put everything down. And just be natural. And let everything fall away for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and learn to stop 20, 30 times a day. For 5 minutes, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and just put everything aside, including your meditation, including everything, your cell phones. I hope you all put your cell phones away and lock them away. Yeah? Yeah. Did they get the instructions? Oh, please. Get rid of those cell phones. Turn them off, lock them up. Computers, just please do that. And learn whatever you're doing, except in the kitchen, to completely stop. So if you're meditating, you're doing mantras, stop. Let your mind rest in vividness. Just be. Be nothing. Be whatever. But let it come to rest instead of doing, being busy. Even busy meditation is destructive meditation. You can be too much meditating, too much busy meditating, trying too hard. Just be and try to be absolutely natural. Okay? So that's another meditation. There you go. 20, 30 times a day. 10, five times an hour, just stop. Great. So a few things for today, and let's finish with a glorious dedication and aspiration for all sentient life. Page 8. Is our Umzi still there?
Yes.
Mr. Umzi.
Yes.
If you would lead us in the dedication aspiration.
Yaya namo
No, that's fine. I think we'll just end there today, Michael. If you'd like to say it in English, that would be great. The dedication aspiration.
Yes, sure.
Ah, thank you. Great.
Namo Bhagavan Subhadas in the 10 directions and 3 times. All things in the victors, as many as the grains of dust in the field. All of you, please listen and be teach me. From now on, as much virtue as the virtuous actions performed by mind on the spot, speech and mind equal to space, accumulated throughout the 3 times, the stainless virtue existing from the beginning is dedicated together in the expanse of awakening. Having arrived at the state of knowledge of the victors with their children, may the state of knowledge of the Sugatas be totally perfected. The great stages are pervaded by the demonstration of the wheel of knowledge and liberation. May the holders of those stages, having perfected their activities, carry happiness to the world and Dharma to all migrating beings. And may yogins be satisfied with the glory of the 10 virtues. Having purified all the suffering of the samsara of the 6 causes, may we quickly attain the omniscience of complete Buddha. Depending on the force of the accumulating roots of virtue, arising from amazing connections of cause and condition, with the sentient beings of the three times of existing samsara, having actualized the ultimate knowledge of their own awareness, perfecting all stages of primordial wisdom throughout the conduct of Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, abiding in the supreme space free of obscurations. Without objectifying the meaningful benefit of others, according to the capacity of disciples, the reign of Dharma falls corresponding to their interests. Having ripened the disciples into the state of the three Vajas, may you obtain Buddhahood in the vast dimension of Buddha Samantabhadra. In this life, a life that is conditioned, impermanent, and empty, the constituents of the five elements are complete as a Buddha field of the five families. Having arisen in the form of the Guru Vajrayana in the Bardo, may all sentient beings led by those with whom one has positive and negative connections immediately go to the Kacharya. Having ripened and liberated a whole range of disciples, through many emanations, the appearances of one's own primordial wisdom, may you all obtain the unsurpassed ultimate result.
Thank you, Michael. I thought Michael was pausing there for a while with the instructions to just remain in lucid unobstructedness. So we'll say goodbye to everybody, and this evening at 7:30 here Eastern Standard Time will be instructions on hollow body, great loving kindness, inner yoga practice, and also the unfolding the yidam.